Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Colm McCann, whose latest book is Zoli. Earlier novels include This Side of Brightness and Dancer. Zoli concerns Gypsy, or Romani, a woman, and her life. Dancer was a kind of fictional biography of Nureyev. Kind of interesting series of books. It seems that you're moving in many, many different places and trying new and different things. In reading an interview on your website, you talk about how most writers have gotten very fearful about doing different things. Clearly, you're not.
Well, I suppose I grew up fairly safe, middle-class, suburban Dublin. You know, my dad came home. I saw Frank McCourt last week, and he was a good friend of mine. And I said to him, Frank, he said, I'm really envious of you. You had that miserable Irish childhood that you could write about, and I didn't. And I suppose what I'm interested in is those small, anonymous corners of human experience that don't necessarily get talked about in the grand public forum. Hence, a fictional biography of Rudolf Nureyev, yeah, but it's all told by rent boys and soldiers and nurses and stagehands, the ones who wouldn't normally get access to that story. And then with this new book, Zoli, what's extraordinary to me is that there's anywhere, depending on who you talk to, there's anywhere from 10 to 14 million Romani people in the world, gypsies. Although the word gypsy, as you know, is sort of pejorative. You know, that's almost as strong as, say, the Jewish population of the world and, say, the Irish diaspora. But there's very few books. Isabel Fonseca, Martin Amis's wife, wrote Bury Me Standing, a great book. And there's scholars around America and around the world who are doing wonderful things now. But in general, there's no overwhelming narrative beyond that sort of, like, simple idea we have about gypsies. You know, they're going to rob your pockets, you know.
Colm McCann, the way that you discovered the gypsies, in that sense, the Romani, was by the fact that your wife was reading Bury Me Standing and made some mention. How did she find it?
It was just one of those books that she was sort of fascinated by and was sitting by the bed. And, you know, after finishing Dancer, and I'd sort of gone across to Russia and gone through all sorts of weird landscapes, I thought, I really want to do a book about something that I know. But I finally realized that we don't write what we know. We write towards what we want to know. It's an interesting thing. You know, if I wrote about what I knew, quite honestly, I'd be talking about, like, sitting on my fat arse in an apartment in New York, you know, staring at the walls.
It seems that most people who write about what they know, since most writers wind up teaching at university, we get a lot of university novels.
Yeah, we get divorce novels and we get university novels, and fine, and some of them are beautiful, and some of them are technically accomplished, and some of them are radically, you know, they change the way we think. It's just, I can't see myself in that sort of novel. Besides, you know, I have to live with this for 3-4 years. Generally, a novel will take me 3-4 years. And if I'm going to live with it for a long time, I really want to be completely corralled by it. I want to get up in the morning and go to work with whoever it happens to be.
Okay, so she suggests the book to you. Your wife suggests the book. You read the book, I would guess, was the first thing that happened.
That's right, yeah.
And then what? In the back of Zoli, you make mention of the New York Public Library. Did you immediately go to the library? Did you go online? Did you make your reservations for Bratislava at that point? What happened?
That's interesting. I mean, I had this image of Papuszka, this Polish poet who gets exiled from the gypsies, and I thought, what an extraordinary story that is. You know, exiled from some of the world's greatest exiles. And I didn't want to do it. I tried everything else, to go back to Ireland, to write something, you know, in New York where I could manage it. But this woman, and I'd taken her photograph out and photocopied it and pasted her up on my desk. And she looked like Anna Akhmatova to me, or Nadia Mandelstam. And she had this piercing look, and she was always there. And finally, I sort of decided that to get rid of her, I had to write her, or write about her. So I had this amazing gig at the New York Public Library. Actually, the novel's dedicated to librarians everywhere, because I think they're unsung heroes in lots of ways. And that place is extraordinary. But they gave me, through the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, access to an office for a full year, all of the books that I wanted, a very generous stipend, and I could go into the library at any hour of the day that I wanted and wander around and that great institution, you know, on 42nd Street,
sure,
between the lions. So I did an awful lot of research there. But, you know, interestingly enough, I mean, I've lived with homeless people in the subway tunnels to write This Side of Brightness, and I did a lot of research to write Dancer. Didn't know anything about Dancer or anything like that. this was by far the most difficult book because there is so little genuinely provocative scholarship about the Roma. I mean, there are few now, like Ian Hancock down at the Romani Archives and Documentation Center in the University of Texas.
It's kind of strange that there is so little about them. You know, all we know is, you know, gypsies and gypsies steal. On your website, you make mention of the fact that you once spoke with European intellectuals who talked about racism, and you said, well, what about Romani? And they said, oh, they're just gypsies, yeah, as if that discrimination didn't count. Who are these people?
It really is extraordinary the way that we sort of portray the other. Who are these people? They originally came from northern India about 1,000 years ago, and they moved through Egypt, which is where the word gypsy came from, and then scattered up through Europe and sort of went into different parts of Europe. They were enslaved in Romania up until the middle of the 19th century. On a parallel with them, with the African slave movement, I mean, these people, there's been no books about this. Maxio Maximov, a French writer, wrote Prix de la Liberté, but it's not published in English. And so, you know, we have this mythical idea about the, you know, the romantic gypsy with her dangling bracelets. And then we have this brutal idea of the man who's going to come in and, you know, he's going to rip you off. And of course, they're as internally diverse as any other group. They're as internally diverse as the Irish or the Jews. You know, there are Romani psychologists, doctors, poets, scholars and so on. Except they don't say that they are. This is the thing, because it's a huge shame. If you go into your insurance office in, say, wherever it happens to be, Berkeley or Paris or Luxembourg or Dublin, they ask you, where are you from? If you say you're Irish, you're fine. If you say you're Australian, you're fine. If you say you're Romani, you're gypsy, people automatically, they go for their pockets, you know, and they think, ooh, I better be careful of him. He's going to do something to me, you know. So we have this extraordinary prejudice that's really just breaking down now. You start to see in Europe, you go to Budapest, you go to Bratislava, you go to Vienna, and there's these young poets who are angry at last. And they say, we should have been Chechens. We should have been Palestinians. Because you know what they did to us over the years? You know, they sterilized, up until 5 years ago, they were still sterilizing women in Slovakia. They put our sons and daughters into schools for the mentally handicapped simply because they're brown-skinned. You know, people were burnt out. People were discriminated against in the most extraordinary ways. And I did it myself. I mean, I have to say, when I was a kid growing up in Ireland, I'd see the gypsies. And as far as I was concerned, they were knackers. Now, these were Irish travellers. I would have, say, for example, my sister Una, she started smoking when she was 15. And she would go out into the laneway at the back of her house and secretly smoke. And my mother came in one day to talk to my dad and said, Sean, the gypsies have been at the house. Dad said, how do you know? She said, there's cigarette butts along the side of the laneway. You know, and everything could be blamed on them. And be careful, because, you know, if you're not good, the gypsies are going to take you away.
The gypsy culture, the Romani culture, Roma culture. The other thing, of course, is the name. I mean, right. Roma, Romani.
It's a minefield. It's really difficult. Rom means man. The Roma are the people. Romani is the adjective. Romani is also the language. And all of this has really only been put together now. But the people are the Roma, and they have their own Romani culture. But if you call them gypsy, that's the same as the N-word.
On the other hand, if you say Roma, people don't know what you're talking about.
Not yet. They think you're talking about Romanians. There's 2 million Roma in Romania. Romania has just joined the EU earlier this year. You know, in France, there's 350,000. In Spain, there's 500,000. But particularly in Eastern Europe, a lot of them are living in really brutal conditions, let me tell you. Because after I did my research at the New York Public Library, I went to Slovakia to put a map on what I'd already read and sort of imagined. I had two guides take me around to the various settlements. And people were living in mud and wattle huts with no running water, no electricity. You know, they'd have satellite dishes on the roof where they pirate electricity off the road and things like that. The lampposts. People were living in terrible, terrible poverty.
The culture itself. Now, the opening segment of the book is very brief, and it's about this journalist who never appears again, who goes there to look up this poet who you call Zoli,
right,
based on the life of Papusha.
Papusha, yeah.
That's to some degree you, right?
That is me, yeah.
That is you.
Yeah, in many ways it is me. What happens to him is he goes there with all his prejudice intact. And that's what I did. I actually bought a special pair of trousers to go to the camps so I could hide my passport inside. You know, all these trousers that have like dozens of zips inside and everything like that. I thought I was going to be robbed, but I was never robbed. I had robbed myself beforehand. People invited me into their homes and so on.
Well, in reading the book, it's a very patriarchal society. As of halfway through the book, which would be in the late 50s, early 60s, women were not allowed to read.
Right. In the traditional society, there would be, you know, no reading and no writing. There was a book by a gypsy woman, Elena Latskova, who wrote about, like, the fact that she taught herself how to read and write and how she would get beaten and laughed at and spat at and how she was ashamed for reading and writing. But, you know, this is very important now because there are issues of memory here. How do you create memory? Issues of memory, issues of forgetting. How do you get the idea of a culture across if you're not sort of involving yourself in what the dominant culture believes in as communication? And Papushka sort of recognized this in a strange way. She sang her songs, and Zoli modeled on her, believing that it was important to get the written word out there so that people would then preserve the culture.
Well, we see this happening in native cultures in the United States. We saw it happening in oral cultures like Hawaiian culture.
Right.
We see it in the decline and fall of the language of Yiddish among Jewish people. And I guess if there isn't something written about this, the language and the culture will disappear if it's not written down.
I firmly believe that, and I believe that the, you know, important gypsy scholars are saying this right now. It's important to get a grand, overwhelming narrative. And if Zoli does anything, you know, because I'm white, I'm Irish, I'm middle class, you know, I really have no right to get in there and tell the story of a gypsy woman in Slovakia in the 1950s. But it seemed to me that unless those stories get told, that we're missing out a little aspect of it, and maybe wrong, and maybe I can get somebody angry about it and say, what a load of horse manure this is, you know, and take the book and say, I want to write the real book, you know, I want to speak up. Enough of the white writer coming in and talking about my culture. But the nice thing is, the book was launched in New York. The Gypsy Kings actually played music for us and everything. But we had about 10 people who came along speaking Romani. And they thanked me. And one person in particular, he was a banker in New York. He said, you know, I've really been scared to tell people that I'm Romani. And thanks for writing this book, because then I'll get out and give it to people.
Zoli tells the story of this woman through her early days, through the communist years in Czechoslovakia and up through her exile from Roma and her long trek to come to the West.
Right.
All of it is based on research that you did. Now, you went over to Bratislava.
Yes, I did.
You did research on the history, I guess, of Czechoslovakia. There's a character, a poet named Martin Stransky in the book. Is that based on a real person?
I suppose he's a composite of people that I'd read about. He's a sort of radical poet who is part and parcel of the regime post-Second World War, who is a socialist, who he's one of those great thinkers who really believes that poetry is radical, that socialism is the way forward, and he believes in benevolence and decency and good-heartedness, like so many of the people at the time did. But in some ways, this is a book about the human heart in conflict with power, and what happens to the human heart when power starts to shift us and when ideas become more important than the person at the center of them. And Stransky, he sort of stands up against these ideas. He eventually gets executed. And I sort of steal a story from Irish history in his execution when Childers, Erskine Childers, got executed in 1916 rebellion in Ireland. He said to the firing squad, and I love this, he was lined up and they said, do you have any last words? And he said to the firing squad, come closer, it'll be easier for you. And I give that to Stransky. And then there's another character in the book, Stephen Swan, who's an English communist who ends up falling in love with Zoli, but he's scared by his ideas and he betrays her in the end.
Why did you choose the name Swan? Because when we hear Swan, we always think of Proust.
Yeah, we do. I have a friend, Christopher Swan, in England. And, you know, I was aware, like, people are going to think, Proust, I shouldn't do this. But I'd named him Swan all the way along so that he became real for me. And I couldn't lose him anymore. I suppose the mark of, like, when you know or you think you're getting something right is when you turn off the computer and you walk out of your writing room, and it's quite possible that you'll meet the character that you've just created on the page. That would be nice.
You're listening to an interview with Colm McCann, whose latest novel is Zoli. Sometimes I know when I talk to writers and, you know, the book becomes more real than their home life. And sometimes what happens is, in a synchronistic sort of way, right, events in the book seem to start happening in a writer's life.
Yeah.
Did that happen to you at all?
Well, let me tell you, it happened to me most significantly when I was writing Dancer. I went to St. Petersburg, and I had a character whom I wanted to bury in a graveyard in St. Petersburg. Now, I'd researched it beforehand, and I'd decided on Piskaroivskoye Cemetery. Well, I went along, and I hired a young guide to take me around, and the guide said to me, listen, you can't bury this woman in Piskaroivskoye Cemetery in 1959. It just didn't happen. It's a military graveyard, and you can't do it. But he said, but if you want to understand the Russian soul, you come to that graveyard and you look around. Well, we went to the graveyard, and to cut a long story short, there was another small little graveyard in the distance, and we went across, and there was a woman there tending to a grave from 1959. We talked to her for half an hour, and it took the oxygen out of the air when I asked her name. She was the exact same name as the character that I had invented out of thin air. I promise you, it was freaky. I was quite scared.
The idea that somehow there's some kind of connection between the writer who's, I hate to use the word channeling, but, you know, what else can you call it? Something's going on here.
Do you ever be in a bookshop and you're just somehow drawn towards a book? That's little thin little book on the shelf, but somehow your body is leaning towards it and your eyes go towards it and you pick it out and that's the book you fall in love with. Well, what's that about? You know, maybe our lives are guided in a certain way. Maybe it's just a simple fact that we're hyper-aware because we're in that world. But I was talking to someone recently and he said his language changes according to what book he's reading. So if he's reading Martin Amis, he becomes sort of snappy and, you know, quick and, you know, on the ball. And then if he's reading sort of Nabokov or something, it's like it becomes long and languorous and beautiful.
That's also true that a lot of writers don't read the kinds of books that they write because they want to remain pure. I don't listen to other interviewers.
I read the writers that I like all the time. You know, the John Bergers, the Jim Harrison, Peter Carey, all these people who are like extraordinarily important to me. Because I think we get our voice from the voices of others. I love reading poetry. I love reading poetry, and that's what I'll go to all the time. And one wonders if these lines are popping up elsewhere, but, you know, what are you going to do?
There's a poem that Zoli writes. Now, you wrote that poem.
That's right.
Is it based on any Roman poem?
Papushka, the Polish poet, wrote these gorgeous poems. They're simple and straightforward. And I knew that I was going to have to write a poem for Zoli. But I didn't model it on Papushka because I was afraid that I was going to fall into parody. Because it was so simple and so clear and so beautiful that I thought that if I tried it, I'd sort of disease it a little. So I gave her a whole new voice. But it took me about 2.5 years to work up the courage to write sort of epic poem. The poem's called But By the Bones They Broke, We Can Tell New Weather. And it's a sort of long poem about being in the camps and her sort of identification between the Jews and the gypsies, which is quite extraordinary, really. I will tell you that in Europe, the best readers of this book are Jewish people, because they understand exactly what's going on underneath the chatter that's going on. They understand the terror and the movement and so on.
That brings up a thought for me, which is that, okay, Zoli is about this culture that's under the surface. A lot of Dancer is about gay culture under the surface.
Right.
Certainly, everything in this country is about some of the conflicts that Irish people have.
Right.
I mean, they're on one side or the other, but they're torn between both.
Right, right, right.
Which is the same kind of underground feeling. And it seems to be something that permeates your work. And, of course, it becomes, I guess, overt in This Side of Brightness, where we are talking about people underground.
Literally people who live underground. The funny thing is the writers, most of the time, they don't really know what they're talking about. Certainly, maybe it takes a couple of years to try to understand exactly what it is. I remember one stage, somebody told me that I write about maps all the time. And I was like, Oh, jeez, I do. I write about maps all the time. And so I stopped writing about maps. But I know now in general, and I'm 6 books into it, and I think that what I'm writing about is people who are away from home, who are desperately trying to find a way back home, not to the physical home necessarily, but some sort of spiritual home and a sort of joy. Because I am interested in joy and redemption. Like people say, your novels are dark, you know, and I'm not a dark person, you know, I don't carry that sort of sense with me. But I really believe, like Jim Crace, you know, that great English writer. I mean, Jim Crace is an optimist, but he writes about dark, dark things. In the end, my responsibility is to move towards a moment of joy. For example, I'll say to you, when I was down the subway tunnels with the homeless people, this is about 10 years ago now, there was up to 5,000 people living homeless in New York in the tunnels. Every single person, I don't care how high they were, how wrecked they were, how disgusting their conditions were, or how great their conditions were down there, every single person who lived underground New York would say to me, when I get out of here, not if I get out of here, not I will not get out of here, when I get out of here. And there's something in the human soul that really believes that we must work towards hope. You know, maybe that's silly and sentimental, but you know what, I'd rather give full vent to my range of human emotion than die being, you know, a smart aleck or something like that, you know.
Colin McCann, you, in a sense, are an exile yourself, searching for some kind of home, and it sounds to me, maybe I'm wrong, but that growing up now your father's a journalist, mother's a homemaker, you grew up in Dublin, but very middle class, you did the whole middle class thing that we do here. It's not the Ireland we hear about, but it's, you know, it's more like, you know.
Sure, it's like, you know, the Minneapolis suburbs or, you know, the suburbs here in California.
And I wonder, is there a part of you that's yearning for that other Ireland, the Ireland that you were not a part of?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, I would say that James Joyce said in a letter to Frank Bludgeon, he said, I have been so long out of Ireland that I can all at once hear her voice in everything. So part of me loves the country that I came from, and I love it by being away. But the funny thing is, I don't write about it all that much. Not like Joyce, who went back and recreated it. Not like Beckett, who went back and recreated it. But the funny thing, the thing that I think I'm trying to say is that Ireland is now an international place. So that by writing a novel set in Slovakia amongst the Romani people, or by writing a novel about, you know, a gay Russian ballet dancer, I'm trying to say that the Irish story is everywhere. And that's part of our responsibility. Because we've gone everywhere. You know, we're the international mongrels of the world.
There are some people who say that the best way to tell the general story is to tell it in specifics.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The devil is in the details. And also, I mean, it must be said that if you want to know anything about anything, you should write a book about it.
Colin McCann, website, there's this extraordinary discussion you have with the writer Alexander Heman.
I love his work.
You talk a lot about the job or the responsibility of the writer of fiction and the importance, particularly in an era when books seem to be becoming less important.
Yeah, it is scary. And I'm conscious that, you know, somebody may say, ah, for crying out loud, you know, enough of this social responsibility. You know, Steinbeck's dead, Dreiser's dead. But, you know, I have to finally feel that there is some way that you have your finger on the pulse of something new. And if that means sticking your neck out and saying something radical, well, then it has to be done. You know, I don't want a novel sort of diseased with manners. I've had enough manners in my life, you know. I'd rather, stick my neck out and maybe get it wrong. But like Sasha, Alexander Heman, he's such an important writer because he is doing that. Anybody who hasn't read him should read Nowhere Man or Question of Bruno, his collection of short stories. I just think he's really fantastic. And I love coming upon writers like that.
There's a quote. You talk about the MBA stories that are mannered and housebroken, is what you say. And so many of these literary novels, so much of what's published today seems to be that. You know, taking a risk in writing about a person who just died, like Nureyev, knowing full well that you could get battered for that, or writing about a group that could come after you, like the Roma.
Sure.
There's bravery there.
Well, there's a certain amount of bravery, but I don't really see myself as all that brave. I mean, these are the stories that I'm led to. You know, when we talk about these stories that are coming out of some of these university programs, part of the problem is that these kids are 17, 18, and they go into college, and then they go on to an MFA program, and they come out, they're a writer. And their brothers and sisters have become doctors and engineers, and mum and dad say, well, I put all that money, you know, into your education, now you're a writer, now be a writer, as if it's something. They're not going away and doing something that doesn't compute. I think everybody who wants to be a writer, certainly if you grew up like me, fairly safe and so on, you have to do at least, you know, a couple of years of things that you shouldn't do, something like wacky and off the beaten path.
Or be a journalist, I guess.
Or be a journalist. I mean, the first thing that happened to me as a journalist was in Dublin, at the age of 17, I did an investigation into battered women. I had to go out to the flats of Dublin, and, you know, it was an eye-opener for me. Because at the time in Dublin, the early 1980s, we had the largest heroin epidemic. You know, people have an idea about Ireland, you know, the 40 shades of green. I call it the leprechaun-y idea. But there I was in the flats of Dublin with heroin needles littered in the elevators that didn't work, and people bringing horses up the staircase, and kids like owning strange things, and burnt out cars, you know, in the front courtyards. And I said, God, this is my country. And I hadn't seen it before. And I think our big responsibility now is to have empathy. I think politically, part of where we are now has been a failure of empathy. Like, our leaders, so-called, if we can, don't know grief. George Bush doesn't know grief, as far as I can see. I don't think he values the idea of grief. And I think making this sort of weird shotgun empathetic leap towards another culture or towards people who we wouldn't normally recognize, that's a brave act. One hopes and prays that the function of books, the function of literature, is to be some sort of mainstay against that and say, get in whatever way you can. Sasha talks about the power of the writer when I get together with him, and he says, literature sustains me. Literature is what I am. I am nothing without literature. People talk about the death of a novel and it's finished, and I can't see it. I can't feel it. I can't acknowledge the notion that, you know, this art form that's been around, novels that have been around for, what, 250 years, that we're ever going to lose it. Because I took a bicycle across the United States. I talk about things that didn't compute. What I learned at the age of 21 is that everybody has a story. And I don't care how rich, how poor, how black, how white, how southern, how northern, it didn't matter to me. Everybody has a deep need to tell a story. And that's part of our culture, and the way it's sickness right now, is that we're not getting access to being able to tell those stories because people aren't listening because they expect to be told it on TV or whatever. That's why I love radio, by the way. Radio is an act of the imagination.
I wonder about the role of commercialism in publishing.
It's a problem. It's scary. Publishers are as scared as record makers are. Like, they don't know what's going to be great. For example, Frank McCourt's book, you know, Angels Ashes, what, 10 years ago now? They had no idea that it was going to do what it did. And then afterwards, they were trying to publish all these other, like, Irish memoirs that were half as good. They're trying to repeat the success, but we don't repeat success. Something just comes along and it sort of sideswipes us in the most curious way. Do you know what's weird? I'll be totally honest with you. You know, I didn't sell all that many copies of Dancer or This Side of Brightness, but for some reason in this country now, what's happened just to me in the last couple of weeks is that people are sort of understanding Zoli, that American people, you know, it's a European story, that American people are somehow understanding, and that it makes me feel good about where we are now, and like maybe the tide is turning, you know, after last year's elections and things. Maybe people are looking outward more and so on.
Maybe, or maybe there's a certain identification with oppression that we've never had before.
Right. You know, we've gone through this enormous and very important period with civil rights and history, and the Romani people in Europe haven't. And they're right at the cusp of a civil rights movement. And they do look to America and what happened over here. Because believe it or not, those people, they are as oppressed in many ways in certain parts of Europe as the African-American people were over here. And that's an extraordinary story to tell.
And it's a story that doesn't get told. I mean, the halt, the forced settlement, I've never heard of that before. And yet it involved hundreds of thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands of people. The big halt was, like in Poland and in Slovakia and in other countries, the government decided, we want the gypsies to be like us. And so they stopped them from traveling. They took the caravans into the cities. They chopped the wheels off the caravans. They requisitioned the horses for the collective farms. And they put people into tower blocks. You know, and at the time, the tower blocks were the great sort of power of socialist virtue, you know, which everybody lives the same. But they ignored very, very simple things. Like for the gypsies, something as simple as the blood laws. A woman who's menstruating cannot walk above a man, or her skirt cannot be above a man, and she will pollute him. And so they're putting people into tower blocks. And they said, no, we can only live on the bottom floor. People said, but why can you only live on the, you know, no, you must go onto the 25th floor. And then suddenly, all these people had lost their sense of dignity, their sense of culture, and so on. And people were surprised that they didn't want this.
The story is extraordinary. I mean, it is true. You are looking through the dark corners, and I guess that's what literature should be doing.
I think it's what literature should be doing. John Berger, he says, in the most extraordinary way, he talks about this, his whole career he's talked about it, but he says in an oft-repeated sentence, never again will a single story be told as if it were the only one. And I just love that. It's like, okay, we can approach it from hundreds of different angles. The official legislated version of our history that's been given to us by our politicians, by our cultural critics, that's not necessarily the story. Let's tell it from another angle now, too.
Gore Vidal calls that the received wisdom or the received history, and it's just simply not true.
Right. And we must question the history. We've got to call this stuff into question. You know what's really interesting? For a long time, writers have been, you know, like Michael Cunningham, Colum Tabin, have been taking real characters like Henry James, Walt Whitman, and so on, fictionalizing their life. And people are wondering, why is this going on? Well, I think it's going on because there's actually a political undercurrent among literary writers right now who are actually questioning the notion of what is a fact. Because we're given facts. You know, Colin Powell stands up there many years ago and says, this is a fact. I'm holding a photograph. This is a fact that is a photograph of a tanker. Therefore, it's a chemical tanker. Therefore, you know, it has weapons of mass destruction. And these facts get manipulated because facts are mercenary things. You can pack up a fact and you can ship it wherever the hell you want it to go. But writers, novelists, poets, playwrights are interested, I think, in texture, textural truth. And so this movement that we have now where people are writing about like real things, some people say it's a failure of the imagination to write about Rudolf Nureyev or whatever it happens to be. Oh, why don't you just make up a story? I think what writers are saying is question the official history. Question who your teachers are. Question who your politicians are. Question who yourself are, you know. And if you do that, then we become sort of more open people. And maybe we can understand that woman who's tending the fruit market in Baghdad. And maybe we'll become a little bit better in the long run.
Colin McCann, are you working on a new novel yet?
I am. You know, the funny thing is, 5 years ago, I actually said that to write about real people showed a failure of the imagination. I thought this stuff too. I've been thinking for the last 5-6 years that the World Trade Center stuff, you know, DiLillo's going to do it, and it's been told, and it's impossible to tell it. But I want to write a New York book set around 1974 that all takes place in and around the World Trade Center in order to say that where we were then is where we are now, because, like, we had Vietnam, they were coming home from the war. The internet was starting. The first emails were sent in 1972, believe it or not. You know, hip-hop culture was beginning. Nixon was about to resign. All that stuff was going on. And so I'm sort of working on that.
You've been listening to an interview with Colum McCann, whose latest novel is Zoli. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.